So we're really lucky to have our speaker today, who is Dana Blanchard and a member of the ISO in Chicago in the USA. She covered the teacher strikes for Socialist Worker, and before that she was a teacher in California for 15 years, so she comes to us with a lot of credentials and experience. Please make her very welcome.
Thank you. Thank you so much. So first, I'm going to explain my T-shirt because somebody asked about it. And I'm wearing a T-shirt from West Virginia. I don't know how familiar people are with some of the teacher strikes, but West Virginia was the first state to go out on strike. And West Virginia is made up of 55 counties. And there was a point at which it wasn't clear if all 55 counties were going to go out. The rebellion kind of started in some of the southern counties, and then it spread, and then people tell stories about them watching the news to see which counties were closing schools the next day, because it was literally like a map that were like it would go red when they were closing the schools. And so 55 United, 55 Strong was one of the chants, and they have like a little hand signal that goes with it. It's really cool. People should check out some of the videos that are online from the strikes. I'm going to show a few photos and talk a little bit about them, but there's a wealth of information about the strikes online if you want to look for them. Also, we had a plenary session at Socialism in Chicago in July where we had teachers from all the teacher strikes speaking, and it was incredibly powerful, and that is online as well. If you Google like Socialism Conference USA teachers strike, it'll come up, and I recommend watching that too, because I'm not one of the striking teachers, and you should hear from some of them because their stories are really powerful. So let me tell you what I'm going to try to cover today. First, I want to kind of convey to you some of what it was like to be part of the teacher strikes in the U.S. And why, for us and for everyone, it should be a pretty big deal that they happened. Then I want to talk about some of the roots of the resistance in public education, because while these strikes did seem pretty spontaneous and come as a bit of a surprise, even to those of us on the organized left, they are built off of years of neoliberal policy that's been happening in public education in the U.S., some of which I've heard people, politicians in Australia are trying to use as a model for here. So I think it's good to go through some of that. I'm going to share some of the key lessons from the teacher strikes for those of us who are organizing in the U.S. and beyond. And then I want to end by presenting what I think is a socialist vision for what public education should look like and the promise of public education, which is, I think, something we can all sink our teeth into a little bit more in discussion. So the teacher strike experience. A wave of teachers and school staff strikes is sweeping the U.S. And I say is sweeping, not has swept, because it's continuing, putting working class struggle back on the agenda and in many states winning significant gains. The strikes raise many issues, including the nature of the modern working class and the enduring power of the strike, the necessity of rank-and-file organizing, and the particular position of schools and public education in our society. So they are taking on much more than just workplace struggles. These strikes have broadened out on a number of issues. A big question for us now is, will this strike wave continue, and in what ways can it challenge the decades of neoliberal policies and cuts to public schools that have devastated the education system in America? I mean, part of the reason I'm no longer a teacher is because it became untenable for me to be a public education teacher and live in the Bay Area in California. It was incredibly unaffordable. And that's the case. I am not an atypical story there. We've lost tens of thousands of teachers in the U.S. because they can't afford to teach and live where they teach. So on February 22nd, 2018... thousands of teachers and staff from public schools across all 55 counties in West Virginia shut down the entire public school system there. This massive walkout began a 9-day strike with thousands protesting on the steps of the legislature in the state capitol in Charleston, West Virginia. The West Virginia strike ultimately won a 5% raise for all public sector workers, a freeze on state funding for charter schools, and it set off a wave of strikes in other states across the country. The 5% rate raise is really significant because initially they were being offered 3% and then 4%. And then the final offer that was made by the state legislature was 5% for teachers, 3% for everyone else. And they actually organized to stay out 2 extra days in order to win 5% for all public sector workers. So it was a really big deal that they held out on the basis of solidarity. And the other really exciting thing is that a lot of these strikes occurred in so-called red states, which I'll talk about in a minute, and right-to-work states, which means states where teachers aren't covered by a collective bargaining agreement. And unions don't have the right to collectively bargain with their public employees. I was fortunate enough to have witnessed the West Virginia strike firsthand while covering it for Socialist Worker. For pretty much everyone on the left, including myself, the strike in West Virginia and the strikes that followed in quote-unquote Trump country, and the strikes that will probably be continuing this fall in Los Angeles, Washington State, Vancouver County, Clark County, and Washington, and more, have been incredibly inspiring. At the same time, like I said, they've been rather surprising for many of us, even those of us who've been in the labor movement for a long time, and even those of us who've been teachers. So this kind of felt like it came out of nowhere. I'm going to go through the roots of some of this resistance, but it was incredibly inspiring that this happened in places that most people on the organized left didn't think it was possible to happen. So West Virginia was the state in the union that went the most for Trump in the 2016 election. It also went for Bernie Sanders in the primaries. So it's a state that is full of contradictions. Like I would argue all of quote unquote red states in Trump country in America is that there aren't these pockets of like deep conservatism that is much more a contradictory picture. The energy in the West Virginia Capitol after schools had been shut down for 9 days when it was announced that they had won was electric. I was there and it was incredible. It was that of a group of people who had just gotten a taste of their own power, the power of workers organized in mass numbers against their bosses, the power of workers to actually win something. This feeling of power is unfortunately not a common one for most workers in the labor movement today in the U.S. and probably here as well. I do have to say I may have cried a little when people were singing Take Me Home, Country Roads, which is a terrible song. But in the context of striking teachers singing it in the halls of the Capitol building, it becomes a beautiful anthem of resistance. And it was really, really amazing to be there in that moment. So I want to show a few pictures about that strike and some of the other strikes. But West Virginia is the one that's nearest and dearest to my heart because it's the one I was at. I'm going to try to kind of convey through some pictures some of what was going on. So this is the first picture is just to give you a sense of what it was like in the Capitol building to have thousands of people packed into the state Capitol. One of the things we learned was that state Capitol buildings have wonderful acoustics. Those round domes that are on every state Capitol in America are excellent for echoing. And so we were literally chanting for hours and hours and hours. And then like behind doors, the legislature was trying to decide what to do. And you could tell every time they would send someone out that they were a little terrified because the echoing was so loud. I mean, it really, like, it was incredible. The walls were shaking. It was an amazing experience to have. And people were there for days. And people traveled hours to get there. The United States is a huge place. Yes. And so just to get from the southern counties in West Virginia to the Capitol is a two-hour drive. And people would get up at 5 in the morning and drive up and then drive back late at night and make that trip every day in order to be part of the rallies in the Capitol. Teachers have an incredible capacity to make cool signs. This is just like a snippet, but there, like people should Google some of the signs. I couldn't upload some of the photos, but like, you know, we are the resistance with the Star Wars logo, like just snarky plays on words, just amazing, like making fun of the state legislature. The governor, Mitch McConnell, is a terrible human being. There were a lot of anti-Mitch signs. So just the signs were amazing, and people made them themselves. So, you know, I like this one. There's the whole idea that, like, teachers should be role models, and people are like, yeah, I'm a role model for standing up for yourself and doing what's right. So, like, don't, you know, take your moral high horse argument with me, which was great. These are some photos of there were pickets up at local schools as well. So while many people traveled to the Capitol, people also picketed outside their schools. A lot of parents and family members came out along with students. And you can tell it's cold. It's February in West Virginia. There were several days it rained. And the community support for the strike was amazing. A lot of students in America, the only meals that they get are through public schools, through free and reduced lunch and free breakfast program. And so when schools shut down, it really does shut down a lifeline for a lot of our students. And so people were concerned with the school shut down that kids wouldn't get to eat. And so they organized community kitchens. And in communities, different groups took on. So some of the local churches, I know the girls track team at one school organized a lunch buffet where they had sandwiches and everything. And people just really took on the work collectively of serving the students while the schools were shut down. And then some of the students were out as well. I got to tell you, students love their teachers. So, like, don't piss off the teachers. Like, don't think you're going to divide the students from their teachers. One of the teachers, Katie Endicott, who I interviewed for Socialist Worker, who a lot of people know because she's kind of a badass. She's like kind of an internet sensation. She talked about going back to school the day after the strike and people treating her like she was a rock star. Like, her kids being like, yeah, yeah, woo, way to go, Miss E. Like that was really a cool experience for her because she wasn't sure how people would react when they came back to school after the strike. And it was an incredible experience. This is a picture of Oklahoma. So just to give you a sense of, like, mass rallies at the Capitol, that kind of became a model after West Virginia that people would go and basically confront the legislature firsthand, because people had to confront the legislature. When you have no collective bargaining, it means the only way you get a raise is through legislation passed by the state government, which is a pretty high bar. It's not about, like, making a deal with your local city council or superintendent. It's literally like you have to go to the state capitol and petition new law to say you get a raise, which is what the teachers did. This is Arizona. I know it's, like, really tiny, but, like, 70,000 people turned up at one of the rallies in Arizona, and it was just, like, this flood of red in the streets. By the way, Red for Ed became a thing. Arizona teachers kind of started it, but then it spread. There's a Red for Ed National Day of Action on Tuesday as well, so if people want to post things on Facebook that say Red for Ed on Tuesday, I think people would be super excited about that in America. But Arizona teachers are continuing to struggle. They got the legislation passed that basically gave them the raise. And then the governor said, well, there's no way to fund it. You're going to have to figure that out. So they gathered hundreds of thousands of signatures to get a measure on the ballot to tax rich people in Arizona, of which there are plenty. And the Supreme Court just ruled last week that it was an illegal ballot initiative and it won't be on the ballot in November. So they're calling for a national Red for Ed Day on Tuesday to support their strike to tax the rich in order to fund their raise. This is another Arizona picture. I know, again, they're tiny, but, like, huge amounts of people. Like, biggest rallies in Arizona that some people had ever been to, which was incredible. And then this one is super tiny, so I'm going to try to blow it up a little. Let me see if I can. Oop. Shoot. Sorry. Now you get to see. No. Maybe it doesn't work. Does it work? Okay. So I know you're seeing all the nonsense behind this. I don't know if there's a way to just show the picture, but don't make me go all West Virginia on you. Like, that just became both a joke but also a really strong slogan, and kind of amazing that people were connecting the dots. So it's hard to capture how incredible this education strike wave has been. A rebellion in right-to-work states in areas that voted heavily for Trump that was built through rank-and-file organizing efforts and not from leadership at the top. Truly, truly groundbreaking. So I know that I've been somewhat repetitive on that, but it's just incredibly groundbreaking in American politics. In addition, because public school employees had to directly challenge the state legislatures for raises and benefits, these strikes became so much more than a contract battle. They've become a space to talk about the larger priorities of a system that spends billions of dollars on weapons and wars and pennies on the well-being of American children. I would argue these strikes are an important model not only for the labor movement and for those struggling to defend public education, but they're models for the whole working class because they've shown the pivotal power of workers in the resistance against budget cuts, declining living standards, and the decrepit conditions of public services in our society. So now I want to talk a little bit about the roots of the resistance, the neoliberal attack on public education, and what that's looked like in America. So this burst of working class resistance, though it may have appeared to come out of nowhere, has roots in the chronic and deliberate underfunding of the public schools in America. On the heels of the Great Recession, funding for public education has been slashed in states across the country. Most of these cuts came at the state and local level, with federal funding for education remaining steady at about 10%. One of the arguments is like, hey, when states are in crisis, maybe the federal government could chip in more than 10% to fund schools if they're really, you know, Obama, if you're really that concerned about public schools. Republican governors and state houses bent on cutting income and corporate taxes have further gutted school coffers. But they have not been alone. Democrats have enthusiastically joined them in bipartisan attacks on funding for schools and public services across the country. Together, they've imposed a bipartisan program of neoliberalism, which includes privatization, deregulation, and deep cuts to state programs, in particular public education, as well as shifting of public money into privately controlled charter schools, which is another huge fight. Recent tax cuts for the wealthy, thank you very much, Trump, have further starved education funding. Here's a quote from the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. It says, as of the current 2017-2018 school year, at least 12 states have cut general funding, which is the primary form of state support for K-12 schools, by 7% or more per student over the last decade. According to a survey conducted by the same group, the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, seven of those 12, and listen to these states, Arizona, Idaho, Kansas, Michigan, Mississippi, North Carolina, where they also had a strike, and Oklahoma, enacted income tax rates costing tens or hundreds of millions of dollars each year rather than restore funding to education. So that's the level of crisis that sparked some of this in terms of funding. While these dozen states have seen some of the most brutal cuts, it is also clear that making a living as a public school employee has become almost impossible in most cities and states. National Public Radio, in partnership with the research group EdBuild, created a graph showing teacher salaries adjusted for cost of living. This graph explains why teachers move across state borders to find better paying jobs, dramatically highlighted by how many teachers in Oklahoma left their state for better paying jobs in Texas or Arkansas. This was a common reason why Oklahoma schools were understaffed. People literally moved across state lines to Texas, which is not seen as like, most people do not think of Texas as a mecca for well-funded education, but it's better than Oklahoma. But the numbers also show how little teachers are actually making when you take out monthly housing, food, healthcare, and utility bills. So this graph basically showed that even though in some places it is at a crisis level, there is pretty much no way public school teachers can make a living in most cities across the country. It's not possible for most households in many states to be able to support a family on a teacher's salary. Many public educators work multiple side jobs in order to make ends meet and pay off student loans that are accumulated through years of higher education that's required to be certified as a teacher in the United States. Viral videos on Facebook featuring teachers talking about their second and third jobs put a human face on this struggle. That's another thing people should look up if you haven't seen some of them. The number of Uber drivers, bartenders, and waiters who are also teachers is shocking. And we met a lot of them through the course of the strikes who had to leave the picket line to go to their second or third job. Working at a bar in the evenings after teaching. I can think of nothing more horrifying than going to a second job after teaching 8-year-olds all day. Gives me a little bit of heart palpitations. But people are doing it. The vast majority of people we met had other ways in which they were supplementing their income. According to a study from the Economic Policy Institute, public teachers' weekly wages are on average 17% lower than workers who have comparable education and job situations. Because in the U.S., you need a lot of education and a lot of debt to get certified to teach. So people who undertake similar amounts of student loans and things like that tend to make 17% on average, but often way more than what teachers make. The gap between teaching and other comparable jobs has increased nearly 10 times since 1994. So while pay is important, we all know that the attacks on teachers goes beyond just the salary scale and the rising cost of benefits like health care and pension funding. You can talk to me later about the health care and retirement funding questions. I don't have time to go into it here, and it's very depressing. But basically, we're forced to put our money into a public retirement pension fund, but we're being told now that that money has been spent. And so a lot of people are panicking because you're barely making ends meet. And now you have to figure out how you're going to have a retirement plan in addition to pay your healthcare costs, because we do not have free healthcare in the United States. Since No Child Left Behind became law in 2001 in America, the federal and state governments have imposed high-stakes standardized testing on public education, which is another aspect of this attack. Now teacher evaluations and school funding are directly linked to how well students perform on tests that often have little to do with what students are actually learning. This education regime has reduced teachers to teaching for the test, undermining their sense of self-worth and placing enormous pressure on them to perform in deteriorating conditions. Dilapidated and sometimes dangerous buildings, overcrowded classrooms, out-of-date textbooks, and inadequate supplies. That's another Facebook thread that people should follow, is some of the pictures of what U.S. classrooms look like. Oh, crap. I will try to speed up. At the same time that public schools have been under the gun to produce results, a massive private charter school industry has developed. Like a vampire, charter schools replicate rapidly, are hard to kill, and they suck money and resources away from public schools. They also refuse to accept all students, so often they turn away students with special needs or students who are quote-unquote low-performing, which means the public schools get even more impacted because, you know, education is a right and everyone has a right to attend school. And public schools take that very seriously. Charter schools do not. The horrific impact of the economic attack on public education also has sharp sexist and racist dimensions. Because teachers are overwhelmingly women in the United States, these cuts have impacted the ability for women workers to close the wage gap and provide for themselves and their dependents. At the same time, states have invested heavily in policing the schools as part of the so-called war on drugs, zero tolerance, anti-bullying even is sometimes used as a way to bring police into the school, producing what activists now call a school-to-prison pipeline that disproportionately affects Black and brown students. The racist dynamic within schools has been compounded by the mass layoffs of teachers of color as well. So it has many dimensions, the racist attack. These economic and social conditions are the reasons why teachers in the current struggle are angry about the lack of dignity they feel at work. In West Virginia, one of the chants we heard a lot was, "We are worthy." Which is about more than being able to pay your bills. It's about creating a respectful workplace and a demand for teachers to have a voice in what their students learn and the conditions in which they are learning. With these underlying conditions, it's less than surprising that the public school workers around the country have begun to rebel and that this rebellion is spreading. Decades of bipartisan neoliberal restructuring of public education in both quote-unquote red, i.e. Republican, and blue Democrat states is not new and has previously led to paralysis on the part of teachers and public sector workers. But these conditions have also stoked a subterranean fire of anger among teachers, students, parents, and frankly, the entire working class communities who they serve, who are tired of the state of public schools. Such anger can only be contained for so long before it bursts forward into resistance. I think it was thus not a question of if, but rather when the teachers would rise up and fight back. When they did, they were able to galvanize popular support for increased wages and public funding for schools, because the working conditions of teachers are the learning conditions for our students. And people across the working class want more for both teachers and students and themselves. Once it started and won in West Virginia, the power of a positive and inspiring example has really turned into a strike wave. People should know that it continues. Washington State teachers are out on strike right now. Los Angeles teachers, it's just confirmed yesterday, voted 98% to go on strike. And when asked whether or not they would still go on strike if their salary demands were met, the vast majority of teachers said yes, because they are fighting to end the 46-to-1 class size ratio that currently exists. So one adult with 46 students, and that is their number one demand. So this is not just about people getting a raise. So now I want to talk about a few lessons from the strike wave. The most important thing that the teacher strike wave has demonstrated is that there is an alternative to the failed business unionist strategy of trying to make deals with the bosses. And in the case of public service employees, the politicians are our bosses. So there's always this drive to like make a deal with the politicians, elect the right bosses, things like that. Since the strike at United Parcel Services in 1997, I would argue there has not been such a galvanizing and exciting moment in the U.S. labor movement. The fact that these strikes have taken place in predominantly right-to-work states and been led by rank-and-file workers, both within and outside of the official unions, a lot of the teachers who were on strike were not actually union members when this happened, is even more impressive. As workers around the country organize in the hostile conditions of a post-Janus America, Janus being the right-to-work bill that just got through the Supreme Court, it's critical to see the return of grassroots militancy in the labor movement as the thing that will help unions not only survive, but grow and challenge these right-to-work conditions. More than perhaps anything, the strike showed the distinctive power of workers. The past decade of rising wealth inequality has given birth to a new radicalization in America, starting with the Occupy movement and finding expression in the presidential campaign of Bernie Sanders. It has also given rise to movements against oppression like Black Lives Matter and Me Too. While this radicalization has raised class consciousness, it has done so largely in the absence of significant strikes that demonstrate workers' unique power to shut down the system and win some of these demands. While the solidarity and support for the strikes has been large, it is still not totally clear what the trajectory of the growing resistance of the public education workers will be in the long term. Moving forward, this period of resistance will continue to be volatile, with struggles popping up in places we might not expect them, even in states that voted heavily for Trump. It's clear that the underlying structural problems with public education will not go away and will continue to be a point of contention between workers and the state. Whether these struggles have a base in workplace organization and strikes or take a more electoral focus remains to be seen. And I would argue people like some of the teachers I met and the teacher militants and people like us in this room have something to say about that and to keep it focused on the workplace action and not turn it into an electoral focus. Hopefully the most important lesson workers have learned from these struggles is that our power is in the workplace. We need to use this power to demand funding for schools and instead of relying on any so-called friends in elected office to champion our cause, we must do it for ourselves. In this regard, the teacher strikes have shown a way forward not only for teachers, but for the entire U.S. labor movement. The recent Janus ruling in the Supreme Court, which I referenced before, if people have questions about it, let me know, will be devastating for the union movement. Already unions have lost 30 to 40% of their members. Who've opted out of paying dues because they don't feel like their union does anything for them. Janus significantly reduces the resources unions have to fight and make it harder for workers to bargain collectively and enforce things like basic contracts. On the other hand, the teacher strikes have shown us a ray of hope, hope that the self-activity of workers organizing from the bottom up can move both the labor movement and the entire working class forward. This wave of strikes has also confirmed an argument that socialists have long made, that workplace organizing is key in building the resistance to neoliberalism and austerity. Using our power there is ultimately the only way we will win back what we have lost. Strikes are also a way for workers themselves to learn about their own power and for the working class to see the way in which the capitalist system is fundamentally organized, not around meeting human needs, but around the drive to defend class exploitation and inequality at all costs. So many of the teachers who met through this strike, they're not all socialists, but they've all had a profound life experience being on strike, and they have moved much closer to socialist politics because of it. And that's really, really important. When we talk about how we see a socialist movement growing and how we see class consciousness changing, I would say things like being out on a strike and learning your power as a worker is one of the greatest experiences you can have to move you in the direction of seeing what's possible. So I want to close by talking a little bit about socialist vision for public education. It's one of the greatest foundational myths of the American meritocracy that education is the quote-unquote great equalizer. I don't know to what extent that's used in Australia. I would imagine it's similar everywhere. Nothing could be further from the truth. As anyone with any experience in public education knows, our educational system is profoundly separate and unequal. As one of the last remaining public services in the United States, our schools are today's battlegrounds, the final frontier in a war to privatize everything. Corporate America salivates over the $650 billion education budget as they continually try to find ways to siphon it off into private hands through charter schools, testing firms, for-profit textbooks, the amount of public money that goes to for-profit industry. It's disgusting. And the Gates, like, don't get me started on Bill Gates and what he's done to public education. It's disgusting. The current wave of teacher resistors join a long and illustrious history in a nation that was founded on the basis of a contradiction: the promise of equality and the wholesale denial of that right to millions of people who were slaves. Education has always been a battleground in the U.S., from secret meetings of slaves to learn to read and write under pain of death, to the fight against racist Indian boarding schools, to the thousands of schools opened by the Freedmen's Bureau in the South under radical Reconstruction, to challenges to the separate but equal doctrine of the 1950s, legitimized by Sylvia Mendez, Brown versus Board of Education, and made a reality by Ruby Bridges and the Little Rock Nine. I say these names, if you don't know them, some of you should look them up. They're phenomenal stories of the fight in public education for equality. So it is a battleground. It isn't just something we want to give up on. It's a space for contention, and we have a long legacy of that fight for equal education. As educators and school activists today fighting to defend public education, we stand on the shoulders of giants. If these prior struggles can give us inspiration, they also remind us that in fighting the current assaults, we are not fighting for a return to some mythical, glorious past of equitable public schools that provided all students with the education they deserve. Instead, we continue to fight for quality public education for all, a possibility that, to quote Langston Hughes, quote, never has been yet, and yet must be. So I want to end with some collective thinking about what public education could look like if it wasn't dominated by capitalism. In other words, what would liberatory education look like? An education that has never existed in the U.S. in public schools, but ultimately is the vision that guides all of our struggles. Here are some things to think about, maybe to dream about a little bit. What has never been and yet must be? What would be the role of teachers, students, and families in making choices about what is learned in school in a different kind of society? What it would certainly far outweigh the influence of the for-profit testing industry. So that would be a starting point. We wouldn't teach what's on the test. We would decide collectively what would be taught. And what would we teach? Art, music, kinesthetic learning would no longer be relegated to after-school time, but rather valued and prioritized during the school day. Different ways of learning would no longer mean special education or general education services, but alternative learning experiences would be available to all students without stigma or shame. And people who choose to work in education would be able to make a life for themselves and their families and have all the materials their students need. And we would be able to work collaboratively rather than competitively with our coworkers. Instead of a Hunger Games-like approach to test scores where you constantly have to be better than yourself last year and your neighbor, we would be able to actually work collectively to decide what our students should be learning and how to measure their growth. We would define learning in completely new ways, based on the ideas of someone like Paulo Freire, a socialist educator, and not someone like Arne Duncan or Bill Gates, who are terrible people. Just taking a few minutes to talk about this vision can help point a way forward for some of the aspirational demands we must raise as part of this education justice movement. It cannot be just about halting the worst of the scorched earth policies of neoliberalism, but also about demanding more funding, more control by the people who actually participate in public education, and ultimately a system of education that could actually realize its real promise, in the Langston Hughes quote, what has never been and yet must be. That's all.